Hi, my name's Tori and I wish I knew more about blood products.
Hi, my name's Letitia. I wish I knew more about taking care of myself when starting shift work.
Hi, my name is Lydia. I wish I would know more about how to work as in a team and solve conflict.
Hello, welcome to Five Things, the nursing podcast from the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. My name is Liz Crowe.
I'm Jesse Spur, and this is a podcast by, for, and with the amazing nurses and health professionals in our corner of the world. We hope to connect with a global community as we move from surviving to thriving. Welcome to Five Things.
Hello, my name is Liz Crowe.
I'm Jesse Spur.
Welcome to another episode of Five Things. And today we're welcoming Dr. Olivia Holling-Drake, who is the senior lecturer at the School of Nursing at the Queensland University of Technology. And she's coming to talk to us about something very special today, stigma in healthcare. Welcome, Olivia.
Thank you.
There's a big origin story required here, I think, to join the dots from starting as a nurse and then ending up doing your PhD focus around stigma in healthcare. Take it away.
Thank you. So, yeah, I did train as a nurse straight out of school in South Australia, and I went through the university system there. And then I worked in medical surgical wards for a couple of years in Adelaide and then overseas in London, did my stint, and then ended up in Sydney. And they were looking for nurses in oncology. And so I thought I'd give that a go, and I absolutely loved it. So I gave that a good probably 10 years, 15 years. And during that time, I moved back to London again. And then I ended up here at the Royal Brisbane, moved up here in 2004. So worked in cancer care here at the Royal Brisbane for probably 10 years. And during that time, I worked in the chemotherapy day unit here for the most part. And then I also did a stint in the haemophilia centre, so working with people with inherited bleeding disorders. And that was probably where I first started working more closely with people who were living with bloodborne viruses, HIV and hepatitis C, because that population, people living with haemophilia, were quite affected by that during the early 80s when the concentrated blood products that they needed to control their bleeding also came along with some viruses which were at that stage undetected. And so I was working with people who'd been living with HIV for almost their whole lives. And so one of the things that happened, and it was something I just noted at the time and I didn't really think much of it, but was there was a patient chart that was on my desk, and another staff member came in and looked at the chart and said something along the lines of, oh, I don't want to touch that. That person's got HIV. It was clearly marked on the chart. And I thought, well, that's weird. Not very nice. Odd thing to say. But then I didn't really at that stage think for one second that I would challenge that person. But it did open my eyes to something that I'd never really thought about before, which was stigma. And so during that time, I also started doing my master's in public health, and it took me years and years to do it because I had young kids. So about 9 years later, I finally got my master's, and then my supervisors at that time asked if I'd come on and do a PhD with them because they just got some funding to do a project in HIV and looking at the social support networks of people who recently diagnosed with HIV here in Queensland. So that was kind of the segue.
So it's, you know, you had an experience that triggered something for you that has led you down a pathway that you've now become passionate about. And I guess this is something that we need to bring to the forefront, don't we? Because wherever we're working in healthcare, we're working with vulnerable people, and that we may not understand what our stigmas are or where our biases lie. So I guess your number one point is, what is stigma and how does it impact people in healthcare settings?
Yeah, so stigma is driven by negative public or general stereotypes about people, but it manifests in the way that people feel about themselves or the way they feel about other people. And it can be internalized or anticipated, which is where people feel ashamed or unworthy, or they feel undeserving of care because they've taken on societal views of themselves or of a condition that they're living with or a circumstance. But it can also be enacted, which is when those negative stereotypes or attitudes transfer into our actions and words. And that can be experienced as discrimination, where people are actually treated differently based on some preconceived view of them and their disease or their social circumstances. And it's important to note that some people's health conditions or circumstances are more stigmatized than others. So things like HIV, homelessness, drug and alcohol, mental health, obesity, some of these things that people do have views or stereotypes that exist. And when that plays out, either internally or when it's actually people are discriminated against, it prevents people from seeking health care. And not just for that one condition, but any care. And you will never really know about it because they'll never really tell you, and you just won't see them until they're in a really bad way.
And I guess the really important thing about stigma is that sometimes we may not be aware of our personal biases or our personal, you know, it still makes me kind of cringe and kind of smile that often when people are giving examples about a surgeon or a doctor, they'll still say he, you know, and it's such a basic one. Our whole healthcare system is full of women doing a whole range of disciplines. But it's so ingrained. And this can be the problem with stigma, isn't it? Is that we've heard something our whole lives, so we just assume that we're more woke than what we actually are. And this is why it's important that we bring it to the fore so that we're consciously making choices.
That's right. And we are all human. I will keep saying that. And we are not perfect. And the way we interact with people is far from perfect a lot of the time. But as healthcare professionals, we are in a position of power over a lot of people, and we do need to recognize that. And actually, we need to be careful how we use that power.
Well, we have to be mindful of that power, isn't it?
That's right. And it's important to remember as well that some people are impacted by multiple different stigmas. So if you think about someone who's, you know, perhaps uses IV drugs, is homeless, and this can be perpetuated by other broader societal stigmas, like stigmas towards based on race, based on age, based on gender. And this is what we call intersecting stigma. And it's impossible for us to know what every person's going through, but it can make it very difficult for people to access and engage with healthcare. So it's important that we recognise our power because stigma makes people less likely to share health information for fear of being judged or for fear of their confidentiality being breached.
I guess the thing with stigma is we also have to be so mindful because we could think I'd never say anything inappropriate, but if we're thinking it, it's on our face, it's in our tone. It's, you know, if someone's in with diabetes with a weight related issue, you know, we can think I would never make a judgment about someone's body type. But if we're like, so what have you been eating over Christmas? You know, it just takes a tone, doesn't it, to really, that can be powerful enough to silence someone or to make them think I'm not coming back.
Yeah. And look, honestly, we have to ask some awkward questions as health professionals. But it is really important to be aware that internalized stigma exists and that when, you know, someone has that shame inside them, your perfectly reasonable question might seem very different to them. But I guess what I would recommend is that when we're asking people questions, we have a good reason to ask them that question. If it's a little bit invasive of their privacy, why do we need to know? And if there's a really good reason, then we probably do need to ask the question sensitively and be curious about their situation. But if we're just wanting to know because we just, you know, think it might be interesting to know, well, we can probably leave those questions out.
And I guess if you've got a difficult question that has to be said, there's ways you can frame it, isn't there? You can say, look, I'm really sorry. This might feel like an invasive question. The reason that I'm going to ask this question is for this. People then can sense that you're being respectful, that you're asking it with a purpose rather than to be shaming. And they, you know, they'll sense and feel that, won't they?
That's right. And you can preface those questions with a little bit of information about yourself and your role to say, okay, well, hey, you know, I'm Olivia, I'm one of the nurses here, and I'm actually able to get access to some different services. So I need to ask you a few questions about what might help you. Is that okay?
Yeah, perfect. So number two is why language is so important in stigma in healthcare settings.
So I put this one in because I wanted to talk a little bit about labelling people, which we tend to do a lot in healthcare. And what we do is it can actually be, and when we label people, it can sometimes be detrimental because it aligns people's whole identity with a single condition. So it's important to say that some people do identify with a health condition that they're experiencing. So there's people who might refer to themselves as a breast cancer patient or a breast cancer survivor, which is great. But I'm going to pose a question here, which is, how often do you hear people outwardly referring to themselves as an anal cancer patient or a vulval cancer patient? And I'm guessing the answer is not that often.
Yeah, that's right.
So given that's the case, is it really appropriate that we as nurses get to choose who's labelled what? And so it's better to just use people's names and go with their lead. And it's important to note that some people actively use labels to help create visibility and to normalise conditions. So people might call themselves autistic, deaf, a DV survivor. These are the types of things you'll hear, but that's a choice they're making.
I think this is a real challenge because particularly if you're in a mixed ward, you know, sometimes people, the patients are moving through rapidly. Yep. And so people will say, you know, the person with TB or the acquired brain injury, you know, in bed 5, because they're trying to shortcut what they're trying to say about a patient, but it's still not okay, is it?
Look, it happens and we've all done it. I've done it 1,000 times. And I guess it's just more about being aware that you're doing it rather than it being just something that you never think about. It doesn't matter if you do it sometimes. Like I said, we're all human. But I think the thing that happens is if you've got someone who's, you know, for example, Mrs. Betty Jones, she's a dementia patient, she's a hypertension patient, she's a diabetes patient, she's a confused patient. Like, where does it end?
Yeah.
And so it's actually, no, she's actually Mrs. Betty Jones. That's her name. And she's living with a range of conditions which affect her health. It's just a slightly different way of thinking about it. And it just doesn't quite perpetuate that same feeling that person is just that condition.
And it's dehumanising.
I think I like the discipline of that forcing strategy of actually going the name of the patient because it does something else quite subtle in terms of a cognitive forcing function of making you slow down. And part of the problem is we're geared so much towards pace and through necessity a lot of the time. And with that efficiency in thinking, we revert to patterns. So we're much more likely to fall back on our cognitive biases, our base operating system of thinking, and ascribe to and transmit those stigmas, aren't we?
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense, and we'll talk about that in one of my points around the culture that we actually work in and how this can actually affect us as well.
And I just think we've always got to think how you would like to be treated yourself. You know, like when you go to see a healthcare professional and they call you Liz and they ask you a little bit about yourself, you immediately start to feel safe. Whereas, you know, if my dad was in hospital and people like the old man with the AF in the corner, it immediately makes you think that they can't see him. They can't in some ways connect with him in a way that makes the family feel safe. And so all of that, you know, intrinsic, extrinsic sort of messaging all the time, we've just got to be so conscious of it.
Yeah, because we actually do care and we do see people as humans. So it's really good if we can project that in the language and the way we relate to other people. And I was also going to say it's really good to consider our norms around documentation in health settings as well and how these can reinforce stigma, because we do actually get a moment to sit and think before we write. So, for example, you could quite conceivably read a line in a medical record that says, a non-compliant dementia patient in bed 5. But would you call your grandma a non-compliant dementia patient? So you'd be better off to say in the notes, Betty has dementia and has experienced difficulty adhering to medications.
Yeah.
It's the same information. It's just slightly less stigmatizing.
I think as well, it doesn't really help you do anything better for that person. So even like the difficulty adhering to medications, unless that's going to be followed up by, these are some strategies that have worked today that we could try to implement, then what does it really actually do, even documenting that?
Well, that's right. And arguably all it does do is actually changes the impression of that person that you leave for the next person who reads that note.
Olivia, if we're going to focus on language, how important then is our handover, you know, whether it's nurse to nurse or nurse to another healthcare professional, in how we like either, you know, reinforce stigmas or if we break that down?
Yeah, so I think end of bed handover is a very, it's something that we put in as a safety mechanism and to be inclusive of people. But because we work in wards where there's lots of people in the room, it can actually be quite an unsafe place for a lot of people. If they're living with conditions that perhaps they wouldn't advertise to the world, and then that condition is being disclosed publicly when the group of doctors and nurses gather around and all chat about you, then this is just something that we need to be aware of how we use our language in those conditions, so that we are staying safe in terms of getting all the right information across, but maybe just tempering what it is that we want the rest of the world to know. And I think most nurses are actually pretty good at this and pretty aware of that space.
Now, this is one of my favourite headings we've ever had in this whole entire podcast. Your number 3 is the pearls and pitfalls of tea room conversations. Please explain to us why you thought this was important to include in a stigma podcast.
Well, it's really important to debrief in healthcare, and dark humour is par for the course for nurses. So we talk about things over dinner that everyday people find extremely disturbing, and I'm for that. I like that about us. And the tea room is a place for debriefing. We all know that. But people still have a right to confidentiality, and it's really important to reflect occasionally on what we actually say about people or diseases in public spaces, because number one, we don't always know who's listening, and number two, we have the power to, in those casual conversations, to reinforce stereotypes and stigma about groups of people. So a good thing to consider when we're talking informally about patients is, can you stand by your comments, or are you just being a bit judgy? Or are we saying things to make us feel clever or funny in front of other people? rather than actually sharing useful information. And so we all have to say things about other people in nursing. So that's a given. But it's different, for example, with one or two close colleagues in a private space compared with a room where there are multiple people and people we don't know wandering in and out of that space. And so it might even be worth thinking about how you would restructure your conversation about a patient if that person was sitting right beside you. And the reason why this is important is because people who are experiencing internalized stigma or shame, they can take flippant comments to heart way more than you might think. So an off-the-cuff comment from you might be a really big deal for them. And these feelings of shame or poor self-esteem are the reason why people don't seek help. And that's how stigma works, to create barriers. So we're nice people, we are, but sometimes what we say can be taken out of context. And it's important to note that if someone ever does challenge you on something you've said, it can be really uncomfortable. Like, it's an awful feeling, and you might kind of go into all fight or flight, like, and argue or, you know, defend yourself. I didn't mean it. Like, and that's perfectly natural. That's a human reaction. But in those moments, it actually, you have to admire that person in a way for speaking up, because it can't have been easy for them. And it's actually offering an opportunity to talk more openly about something. And those are the moments when understanding is reached between two people, stigma loses all of its power. And human connection and understanding is the antidote to stigma. It cancels it out. So conversations are, they can actually be the solution. They're not always the problem if they're handled in the right way. And so I guess the only other thing I'd say about that is, you know, have mechanisms to debrief safely. It is so important. And you guys would know what those mechanisms are in this hospital, because we all need to debrief and we need to talk about patients.
Before Liz gets into debriefing, I think it's really interesting looking at tea rooms. Like, they're a microcosm of the beliefs and values, and it's a space that actually is like a cultural compression of the attitudes of a unit. And if you're on the inside of that, it brings everyone closer. So tea rooms can be this place that brings community closer within the workplace. But if you're a member of the team, in inverted commas, that's not in that group in terms of the beliefs, values, and potentially, like, your point of making sure you don't know who's in the room living with what, it can force people further out. So I think making sure tea rooms are inclusive in the community and the cultural compression, and that you're distilling the culture that everyone on the team wants to be part of.
Yeah, because we are, at the end of the day, professional people. And that is us being professional people, is we're having fun, we're debriefing, we're having a good time, but we're also being conscious and being those professional people.
And I think also, you know, sometimes some of the patient cohort can be very challenging, and we're not denying that. No. And you can be a human being, but I think when you're using any sort of language and you're frustrated, be really mindful that you don't start to categorize all people with that healthcare condition, or all people of a certain race, or all people. You know, you can say, I'm having huge frustrations with Mrs. Jones. It's, you know, like, it's hard and it's frustrating, rather than coming in saying, oh, people do this, or people with dementia, or I can't stand people from up north, or I, you know, you're still able to offload, but you can do it in a way that is not just safe for your patients, it's safe for your colleagues, and it's safe for you, because that's the other thing. You don't want to, in a moment of frustration, do something that could harm your career, harm your reputation, or harm a patient.
Yeah, that's right. And I agree 100% with what you've said. And I know we absolutely do get frustrated. And, you know, you don't work in nursing for 25 years and not have those experiences where you just want to tear your hair out with people. And that is part of our job. And we do need to be able to deal with that. And sometimes we just let it fly. And that happens. I'm just saying, be conscious.
Yeah, be really mindful about that. Right, so your number four is get to know people with lived experience. And can you just explain to us briefly, like, who are people with lived experience?
Well, arguably anyone who's alive. But what I'm really talking about here are peer roles. And so peer workers are people who draw on their knowledge and wisdom gained from having experienced a particular condition or circumstance, and they use that knowledge and wisdom and experience to help others. So, for example, something like HIV, mental health, alcohol and other drugs, hepatitis C, maybe even things like spinal injury and cancer. So people who've had an experience of that, and they use their wisdom to support other people. And it's really important to remember that they're often very skilled and well-trained people with tertiary qualifications, that they're just like you and I. But what they can do is dispel myths and present a really human side to what might be a stigmatised health condition. And so these people might work for Queensland Health. So, for example, our colleagues working in mental health, they will work with peer workers every day. Other areas like hepatitis C or HIV, they might work for non-government organisations. And so your sexual health nurses would perhaps be tying in with some of those organisations, or your AOD nurses. But it's really, I would advise to find out if there's a peer organisation that's relevant for your setting, and find out how to refer people to them. I know working in cancer, the Cancer Council has peer counsellors that you can tap into. I probably didn't really do that too much because I didn't really think about it, to be honest. And I wish someone had told me sooner what this rich workforce can actually do to help people. And just finding out how to refer to those people, where they are, what they can do, maybe even inviting them to speak on your unit and talk to your staff about their experience.
I think that's a really important thing, because a lot of the time I think that's where the well-intended questions and curiosity can come through when we're asking patients about things that aren't relevant to their care. People with a stigmatized position or condition within society get exhausted of having to educate everyone all the time. And if they're here because they're sick, they're probably, unless they're volunteering and taking the lead on those conversations, they're not your source of education on this topic. So peer support organisations or peer worker, is that the term? Peer worker organisations are a great source for that. Or if you're fortunate enough to have community members or I guess patient advocates on different meetings and coming into education sessions is great.
Yeah, it's really important. And it is about tapping into people's wisdom, but doing it on their terms, not when they're sick and vulnerable. And we're not asking peer workers to do our heavy lifting for us. So, you know, for example, if you had to organise a discharge of someone who's experiencing homelessness or mental health, you know, we have to do all of the phone calls and we have to do all the paperwork, but their experience might have taught them something that might work well. So why not tap into that? And I wanted to say one more thing on this point, which was you've got to watch You Can't Ask That on ABC iView. If you haven't watched this show already, it's a fantastic platform for people who experience marginalisation and stigma to share their stories. So if you want to ask all those curious questions, you might find they've already been asked on this show.
Yeah, terrific. So your final point is why cultural safety is essential and why it is not about trying to understand everybody else's culture.
Yeah, so this is because being self-aware about our own biases and judgments is really essential to prevent us from reinforcing stigma. And this is what you said earlier. So good cultural safety training helps us develop the skills for reflection, to develop self-awareness, and prevent our biases transferring into our actions and words. So the idea of cultural safety was born from nursing and from Indigenous perspectives, and in particular from a Maori scholar in the early 2000s called Iri Hapeti Ramston. And it relates to professionals acknowledging the role of power and powerlessness. So Dr. Ramston's research revealed that understanding the politics of marginalisation and recognising and acknowledging differences by ethnicity, gender, sexuality, social status, economic status, disability, age, these are all necessary requisites to recognise and address power relationships. And this is what cultural safety seeks to identify and address. So cultural safety is about awareness of self as much as it is about awareness of others. Because what Iri Hapeti Ramston is saying is that cultural safety is not about understanding everyone's different culture. That's simply not possible. It's about reflecting on power and working to redress power imbalances.
I think that's fantastic because it gives, again, I'm really a big fan of these kind of cognitive stop points and bumps to start self-monitoring rather than operating on autopilot. Because it's one of the problems I have with mindfulness as a concept is you need a point to bump you into being mindful. Otherwise, you would be completely dysfunctional if you're living with permanent introspection in every single activity you did during the day. It's just not
possible. It's not healthy either.
It's not healthy, but it's not possible either in terms of actually functioning in any workplace. You'd probably be rocking in a corner in your own house. So those stop points are going, actually, right, I recognize that I'm probably in a position of power here. And quite often it might be the other way around because we have staff that are actually have intersectional marginalization compared to the patient they're looking after. So it does work both ways, doesn't it? Which I love the point of you don't need to know every single culture. You just need to know I might be in a position where I've got to reduce the power imbalance here, or I might be in a position where I've actually got to increase my sense of authority on this topic because of the power differential.
You sum that up so beautifully. That's really great. I really like that. And so I guess for a place like the Royal Brisbane Hospital here, you know, we have a culture here. The Royal Brisbane has a culture. Nursing has a culture, and it's different to medical culture, for example, but we interact. And westernized health systems have a culture. So what we're actually doing through cultural safety is reflecting on the cultures that influence us and how those cultures might manifest in the way we speak to people and the way we are with people. And so the example I would use is somewhere like Royal Brisbane. I worked here for 15 years. I was pretty much constantly busy and time poor. And it's important to reflect on how being busy and time poor impacts how we interact with patients, because we might be abrupt with someone because we're really busy. We just need to get stuff done. But a person who's experiencing internalized stigma might interpret that as, oh, they've got no time for me because I got myself into this mess and it's my fault and I don't need to be looked after. I don't deserve to be looked after. And so, you know, we can't predict that. We don't know what people are thinking, but we can be aware that we're stressed and busy and it might be impacting the way we relate to the people, not just patients, but also staff.
And I guess, you know, I love that we need to think so much more about, instead of learning, oh, you know, I'm looking after someone today who is Jewish and I don't know anything about it. So even though you're sick, I'm going to take the time to say, I don't know anything about the Jewish faith or culture. Can you explain that all to me? What we need to say is, like, is there a way that this could be impacting their stay here? That's, you know, like, is there something that I'm doing that is empowering or, you know, making this person feel powerless? And I think it's even about constantly being aware when we're bedside that standing over someone is a terrible way to have these sorts of conversations. Pull up a chair, sit down, you know, be mindful of your tone. If you're coming from a really curious place, you might say, I'm a bit concerned about our menu plan. I don't know a lot about Jewish faith. I noticed that it says that. Is there something that I need to be aware or mindful about your diet? There's no way that that can be misinterpreted as anything but someone trying to do the right thing.
That's right, exactly. And when you're reflecting on how you come across to someone, you come across as concerned and interested, and that's a really helpful way of being with other people, and rather than just being dismissive. And the reason why we're dismissive of people is very, very rarely because we don't care about them. It's because there's other stuff going on in our brain, but it might not be interpreted that way by them. And I was going to say also that it's a really good idea to reflect every now and then on nursing culture, as that is our broader audience here. And so how do our values as nurses drive the way we interact with people? And there's so many positive things to reflect on there. So compassion, human-centeredness, advocacy. And the question that I ask is, how do we keep those values close to our hearts when we're tossed around each day by ever-increasing demands of the workplace? And I believe it's possible, but it might mean that we actually have to speak up for ourselves and our profession at times in order to be safe. And so, you know, maybe we do need to advocate for compassionate care rather than a production line from time to time. And it's just food for thought, but it's perhaps something for those in positions of power in nursing to consider.
And everything we do, including our communication, our, you know, thought patterns, it's so patterned, it's so habitual. And so once you start practicing in a way that is very mindful about power, is mindful about, you know, how you're coming across, that becomes your habit. So instead of saying, you know, the person with diabetes, the diabetic in bed 3, it's like, oh, and, you know, I need to go and check on Jenny in bed 3. You know, that becomes your habit. That becomes the way that you think, and you can do it in a conscious way.
That's right. And we're good at that stuff. That's what we live for. And it's so important to say that we're all humans and we all make mistakes and we say the wrong thing and we cringe and it's awful. But any effort to improve our awareness of ourselves and try to understand things from someone else's perspectives and create opportunities to have safe conversations about awkward things that we don't really understand, or even speak up for others when something feels cringy, which nowadays I would do that if I had that situation again where that person didn't want to pick up that case file. I'd probably say something now, never would have back then. This is the work that we all do every day to reduce stigma. And in doing that, we actually all play a role in increasing access to care for marginalised people.
Olivia, you've given us so much food for thought. I'm now going to have an attempt at concisely summing that up. So your number one is, what is stigma and how does it impact people in healthcare? And essentially you were saying that stigma is often driven by general stereotypes that we're not even aware of, and it manifests in how people feel about themselves and others. And often this can transfer or play out in our actions and words. And we have to be so mindful of this in the healthcare setting, because if we treat people differently, they might be so much less likely to re-engage with the healthcare workforce again for anything. So if we make someone feel shamed about having a mental health problem, about having a drug and alcohol problem, they may not ring the paramedics when they've got chest pain because they're embarrassed. And that at all points, we need to recognize that healthcare professionals on the whole are in a position of power. And that for some people, you talked about intersecting stigma, so that there are people who may have stigma due to, you know, their racial background, their age, their disability, and then you can find that that is actually intersected with also health stigma. Number two, you pointed out that language is completely critical in stigma and how it comes across in the healthcare setting. And you asked us to be really mindful of labels. So that can be everything from saying the schizophrenic over there instead of, you know, the young person with schizophrenia, or more importantly, you know, Daniel, you know, person first. And that it's really important that when we're thinking about labels, what we want to do is we don't want someone to be aligned their whole identity with their health condition or with any other vulnerable, you know, population that they may be associated with. And so the only way we can do this is to create visibility and raise awareness. And this becomes, I guess, the words I've heard you say over and over again is reflect, reflect, self-awareness, self-awareness. And that when it comes to language and labeling, we need to be really mindful about our documentation and also about how we're handing over what we're saying, the words that we're using at all times, because we could be unintentionally reinforcing stigma or reinforcing power quite unintentionally. Now, number three was on pearls and pitfalls of tea room conversations. And this is probably, as I said, my favorite heading ever in the podcast. And I think, you know, your tea room can be your greatest source of support, your greatest source and wisdom of knowledge, or it can be the most toxic, spiteful, stigma-reinforcing place in the hospital. And so we've got to be really mindful about our culture and how we're setting that up. And I love that you said every healthcare professional, but particularly nurses, you need somewhere safe to debrief. You need somewhere safe to blow off your frustrations. However, please, please, please be mindful of confidentiality. Be mindful about power in our most, you know, casual conversations. Ask ourselves, what's our purpose and intention of having this conversation? Are we just about shaming people, promoting ourselves? You know, are we just blowing off steam? And if so, is that better done on a one-on-one conversation somewhere privately rather than in the middle of the tea room? Think about flippant comments. Think about what could be the impact for that patient, for your other colleagues who you do not know, who they're in relationships with, what their own health status is, what their children's health status is. What if people could hear you? And what if someone reported you? So I also love that in this section, you finish with saying connection is the antidote to stigma. Number four, you said get to know people with lived experience. And you explained to us that people who have lived experience or who are peer mentors are people who are drawing on knowledge, wisdom, and experience on a condition, culture, anything that they've actually experienced personally. You said if we really want to learn, there's a great, for the people who live in Australia, there's a great show on the ABC iView called You Can't Ask That, where they let people really come and say, all right, ask all the things that you've ever wanted to know about dementia. And people do that in a really, you know, open, curious way. Number five is why cultural safety is essential and why it's not about understanding everyone else's culture. And so for me, the bottom line about this is the only way we can break down stigma, the only way we can create cultural safety is understanding ourselves, being aware of what our own power is, what our own cultural influences have been, and then using those reflections to be aware of what is my power or what is taking away my power in this circumstance. And once you've got an awareness of these biases, it allows us to reflect and engage with people where we see them as human beings first, and anything else attached to their humanness is very much secondary.
Well done. That's amazing. I'm very impressed with your very mild superpower.
Olivia, I think that's been a very thought-provoking podcast for us today. And we thank you very much for joining us today on Five Things.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. The Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital Five Things Nursing Podcast acknowledges the Turrbal and Yuggera as the First Nations owners of the lands we now tread. We pay respect to their elders, laws, customs, and creation spirits.
We recognise that these lands have always been places of healing, teaching and learning. We also wish to acknowledge the First Nations people of the lands of our global community and encourage our listeners to seek out, listen and learn from the knowledge held in your shared space. As well as all major podcast outlets, you can find us at 5thingsnursing.podbean.com. Please also subscribe and give us a rating on your listening platform of choice. This helps others find the podcast. And finally, if you'd like to connect with Liz or myself on Twitter, we can be found at LizCrow2. And for me, it's inject_orange. We would absolutely love to hear your thoughts, ideas, or feedback. Thanks for listening to 5 Things,